same. President Trump ordered a new name for the body of water amid his escalating trade war with Canada, as of Wednesday, Apple Maps shows Lake America for U.S. users, while users outside the U.S. will see Lake Ontario. Canadian leaders have rejected the move. I'm Linda Kenyon, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
For more than 40 years, friends, when you heard that music, the next voice you heard was Don Wooten's. Well, guess what? This week on The Conversation, we get a chance to visit with Don Wooten. Many thanks to Edgar Crockett for doing the sound engineering for a recording in Don's own home. Stick around. We're going to have a lot of fun over the next hour having a chat with the founder of this program and of WVIK itself. Stick around. Don Wooten's coming up. And here I am at a venerable dining table in a beautiful home in a storied neighborhood of Rock Island. Don Wooten, welcome back to the WVIK airwaves.
Well, it's always good to return.
Well, maybe that's where we should start, right, is with broadcasting. You came up river from Memphis a few years ago. And your first love might have been elsewhere, but it seems almost inevitable that you gravitated towards broadcasting. Tell us about how you early on got into broadcasting.
You know, that was not my intention. I didn't know anything about broadcasting, and there was no television in the area. So I entered the seminary, planned to stay there, but after 2 years, I realized I am not built to take orders. I'd have to live at the will of a bishop, and I thought that's just too much. So I quit. I was going to go back to Memphis, but the college asked me to stay and offered me a chance to work my way through, so I stayed. But I was preparing to be a science teacher, and in my senior year, the speech department got a call from WOC Radio. They were going into television and they needed some guys to work in the production department, so they sent me. And I was there in the very beginnings of television. I was on the air three times. Once as an extra voice in Pat's record shop. She mimicked records. I know, twice there. And then the B-flats quartet was invited on, and so I was there. In January of 1950, KWPC in Muscatine called the college and asked if they could send somebody to work on weekends, and they sent me again. I was stunned to find that almost everybody there knew who I was and greeted me as a friend. And that's when I began to regard television with a little caution. And sure enough, for many people, it isn't real unless they see it on TV. In the beginning, that was true in a way because it was all live. But now everything is packaged and it's really become a foil for 3-minute commercial breaks. So it has changed profoundly, but then so have I.
Well, I have to share a story that I've shared with many, and that is when I was working in the newsroom. There was a time when, as ever, people wanted more of your time than there was time available. and you were asked to do something for some local exposition or trade show or something, and you said, come along, because you're going to start doing this for me. So I shadowed you, and what I found extraordinary, because this would have been about 1987, and by that time, you had still been doing the weather on the local ABC affiliate, but it had been years since you were affiliated with the CBS affiliate.
Yeah.
And I thought it was extraordinary walking around with you and having these people just awestruck by your presence and say, Don, I watch you every night on WHBF, which you had been a great legend there, but you hadn't been there in years.
Yeah, I know.
So I think I started to understand that power then.
Yeah, it's television is, you know, we have lived under the influence of things. Movies had a profound influence on the way Americans behaved. When you move those movies into your living room, it merely magnified that influence because they were there in your home. And now it's moved to social media. And all these things influence us in a way that I don't think is really healthy. I'm an old codger, so I can object to these things. But when you watch a movie or a TV program, your mind is generally empty, and they just pour the stuff in. Unless you've grown up reading books and have been introduced to critical thinking, you're just going to be a passive servant of these means of communication. And that's not a healthy thing. iPhones, cell phones. I think giving one of those to a child is like handing them a hand grenade. You shouldn't do it.
It is certainly the case that we no longer have the same common lexicon. We don't have the cultural canon that we once did, but it used to be that everybody knew who you meant when you said Walter Cronkite, David Brinkley.
Yeah.
Now, I couldn't tell you anybody who's broadcasting on any network news source. I just don't know. And most people don't get their news that way. They get it from, you know,
the Internet.
Well, they get it from the Internet, or they get it from Jon Stewart in a cable satire program or something like that, right? And one thing I did want to ask you about, Don, is the knock-on effects of the deregulation of broadcasting in the early 80s. I mean, there used to be a much greater sense of obligation from the broadcaster to the common weal. Yeah. And I think that was deregulated out of existence.
Yeah, it was. It was a disastrous thing. There were all kinds of useful rules. You could only have one station in a market. Now we have one company controls at least three in this market. You, in total, could only have so many stations, radio and TV. Those limits are largely off. One of the things that started with Teddy Roosevelt is trust busting, because all wealth had been accumulated into a few pockets here and there, and that is not healthy. We started breaking those apart. The New Deal came in, and the whole structure of capitalism just collapsed. The New Deal changed the focus of government from serving business to serving individuals. And that is deeply resented by those who used to control the government. And starting in 1980, there's been a concerted campaign to change things back. Mm-hmm. To put the wealthy in control. And the coming election will be a test of that.
We keep seeing these tests, and I'm astonished at what I have seen in my voting life. And the things that I cannot explain to my son and daughter whose voting lives don't extend that far back. It's really you had to be there kind of a deal. But yours is a couple times longer than mine. So when you think back, I mean, is it impossible to search for precedents, or do you just try to hit the buoys as they come by?
If you want a precedent for what's happening now, you've got to go back to Imperial Rome. The Roman Republic was organized by the Senate, which was made up of wealthy elite people, and they were controlled by the two tribunes of the people, who could cancel anything the Senate did. But the Senate picked consuls to serve for a period of time. Julius Caesar decided to make that a power center for himself. After his assassination and the several wars that followed, it was extraordinary. His adopted nephew, Octavian, became Caesar Augustus. And after he quietly eliminated all competition, the Senate and the tribunes decided just to let him do what he wanted. And that changed the Republic into an empire. And we are in the process of starting to do that now. The Supreme Court has given President Trump unprecedented power. Normally, people in office are constrained by a sense of responsibility or shame or something, but it doesn't affect Trump at all.
Well, and we also, our government was structured so that when something like that happened, and I think it worked pretty well in 2016, that there was this balance of powers between the legislative, which has been pretty anemic, but also the judiciary. So the judiciary was more assertive in the first go-round. Well, I don't know, you're probably aware of this, but Nova recently did a special on some archaeological finds that shed light on the democracy of Athens. So I watched that episode. It was fantastic. I didn't realize that nobody stood for election in the Athenian democracy. You were drawn by lots, and you served for a certain period, knowing that whatever decisions you made when you went back to being, you know, Demetrios on the street, you were going to be held accountable for those, right?
Oh, yeah.
But you weren't making a career of it. You weren't profiting from it in any way. You really had to do it for the common good. And their whole strategy was to set up structures that kept one person or one faction from becoming too powerful. And that's what I think the genius of our constitutional system has been until 2024.
Actually, you know, the founders were suspicious of democracy. They knew that history well. And the thing that disturbed them was that the final decisions were made by the assembly of Athenian citizens. But they could be swayed, and they were sometimes swayed to do horrible things. And they decided the people should never be allowed to elect a president or even a senator. Senators are elected by state legislatures, and they set up this awkward thing, the Electoral College, wherein each state was to pick a group of people whose job it was to select the person of greatest virtue, civic virtue. And when they met together, they discussed whom this would be. There was no campaigning for it at all. And they were to pick someone like George Washington of demonstrated virtue. That didn't last through Washington's first term because they were trying to eliminate the power of political parties they immediately formed. And so the whole structure of the Constitution, even the president, has unspoken extraordinary powers because they knew they could trust Washington. But now all that started to go out the window. And we've gone through a very difficult period all the way up to the Civil War where we fought over it. And we decided that there should be no slaves. And we did Reconstruction. But the political party which pioneered the freedom of the slaves decided they wanted power more. And they cut a deal with Southern Democrats. Three states picked a different slate of electors, and the great compromise of, I forget what the year is, gave us a president who didn't have the votes, but he had the power. and the price they paid was to eliminate Reconstruction. It wasn't until 1965 with the Voting Rights Act that we really had a democracy where everybody had an equal shot. And the Supreme Court has undone that step by step.
Yeah, yeah. One more note on the Greeks before we move on to other things, but I always was frustrated that none of those great writers that you introduced us to up in Lincoln Park managed to write about Themistocles. And Themistocles was, I think, great because when they discovered huge silver deposits in the hills around Athens, the people thought this is a tremendous windfall and we'll never pay taxes again and everything will be on Easy Street. But he somehow convinced them that there were these folks called the Persians and they had a lot of ships. And what they needed to do was invest this windfall in a navy. So in many ways, Themistocles saved Athens from Persian subjugation. But it's always stood out in my mind. Nobody has ever since convinced a group of people to give up a shot at personal wealth for the common good.
That's true.
And I don't know how our republic has fared as well as it has for 250 years, despite the temptations to the contrary.
You know, there's a guy... Charles Dudley Warner, I think, is his name. He was a friend of Mark Twain's. And in 1897, he said two things that still resonate. One is, everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. And the other is, politics makes strange bedfellows. When I look at the makeup of the two parties, it's nothing the way it was when I was young, completely different. And I look at the fact that the Republican Party now depends to a considerable extent to people who were Democratic voters, people who were factory workers and so on. And they have convinced them that the Republican Party, which is centered right now on wealth, is the one they should be supporting. And I think, how does that happen? Also, South is now a Republican bastion, used to be a Democratic bastion. There are certain segments that rise up, and as we have compromised the Constitution, first of all, by electing senators from the state, from by the public, and then later on, giving the people the chance to elect the president. All those were seen as reforms, but they haven't quite worked that way. Reforms turn around to bite us sometimes, and it certainly has in politics. It's a topsy-turvy situation, but there are strange bedfellows now in both parties. And the most passionate ones are the ones that dominate primaries. And that was another thing.
Yeah.
Candidates were picked by party leaders, but they decided, I forget one of the reform Democrats, that they should do it in primaries. The problem is people don't vote in primaries, only the passionate.
Yeah.
And so we get these strange candidates.
There is something interesting that, just an observation I read in some columnist lately that a lot of people theorize that Donald Trump was somehow a reaction to a black president. And so it allowed for his rise. Where it breaks down is the Democrats did not answer with someone who was as catering to the far left as Trump was to the far right.
Yeah.
Right? Biden didn't do that. But then Trump came in the second time around and went even farther to the right. In catering to the impulses of the party. And what does that mean for the extreme ends, the far left of the Democratic Party? And we're seeing that play out in these primaries now. Folks that, I mean, if you, you know, have a relatively even pulse and blood pressure under control, you realize that as fevered as you might get at primary time, they're not going to vote for them in Saginaw or in, you know, Charleston, Illinois, or that kind of a thing. They just won't.
Well, you know, socialism depends on government actually owning and running everything. That doesn't work, never has, never will. Communists took it a step further by putting an autocratic center to it. When people talk about democratic socialists, you know, everybody freezes up and thinks, oh my goodness, no, no, no. It means they want to go back to the ideals of the New Deal.
Right.
Start serving the people again. But it's easy to paint them as communists or, I mean, these terms lost meaning.
They clearly aren't, right? No. But I think this taps into what you mentioned earlier. One party has done an exceptionally good job of capitalizing on the human truth that we are motivated by fear. And if you can give someone an enemy, whether it's the commies assaulting Wisconsin in the 1950s, they weren't, or immigrants now, or communists, whatever that, you know, Trump wants us to think they are now. It's always been that way. It was the Soviets, and then it was maybe blacks in the 60s, and then, you know, maybe it was Latinos in the last 15, 20 years. If you give people an enemy, you can make them do just about anything.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you know, we are animals. We share with others these certain instincts. A very strong one is the herd instinct. So racism has been at the center of what the right has done from the beginning. There's also misogyny. Men have this testosterone problem, and they're afraid of women. Women should be running things, I think, at least for a while, so we can sober up. But our problem is we use our intellect to justify instinct. We got it backwards.
Well, next year at the Guild, they're doing Ecclesia Zeuse.
Oh, yeah.
So that would give us a nice, idea of what things would be like. We're going to get into some Genesius Guild things here in just a little bit because they had a very strong season and they've got some very strong prospects for moving forward. But before we get off the political front, you are still engaged in political conversations on a regular basis.
Yeah.
How do you keep up?
It isn't easy. I always read the New York Times, Washington Post, The Economist, and The Guardian. And I subscribe to literary journals that review books, New York Times, London Times, Times Literary.
Supplement?
Supplement. And every day at 4 o'clock, I tune in to see what's on CNN and MS Now, occasionally jumping over to Fox to see if they're doing anything serious. And then I watch a local news just to find out what's happening here.
Sure.
But it keeps me busy trying to keep up with all that.
I'm going to keep advocating that you should put WVIK into that mix of news coverage, but that's the station that you're listening to now, friends. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned. More of Don Wooten on The Conversation on WVIK when we come back. Stay tuned.
WVIK operations are partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council. Support also comes from the Illinois-Iowa Center for Independent Living, hosting the Senior and Disability Expo, Friday, September 11th, 9 to noon at Bally's Quad Cities. Vendors, resources, workshops, amplified phone testing, helping to meet specific hearing needs, and more. Details at 309-793-0090. And support for WVIK comes from the Regional Development Authority, distributing funds from the Rhythm City Casino Resort to help make the Quad Cities a more vibrant and inclusive community. Learn more at rdauthority.org.
It's a new era for public media. We are still here, and we're in this together, so let's get to work. Donate to this station today, and thank you.
Please donate today at WVIK.org.
And thank you for joining us. We're back on The Conversation on WVIK, and I am thrilled that our guest this week is the founder of that august radio station, Don Wooten. Don, we should chat a little bit about this little enterprise that keeps somehow plugging along despite very much aligned national efforts to quash it.
Yeah.
But did you think this would be still plugging away back in August 25th of 1980 when WVIK signed on as the Quad Cities public station?
I had great hopes. It was an accident, really. When I started in politics, I owed the world $5,000. 6 years in, I owed $22,000. I thought, I've got to find a way to make some money, but I don't want to do anything that would be affected by a vote. So I told my secretary in June of 77, what I ought to do is talk Augustana into let me turn that little 10-watt sandbox they have for their students into a honking big NPR station. And Treadway was the new president, said, if you can find a way to do it, do it. So it took 3 years and a lot of help along the way. But we got it done, and it opened so many doors for me, and so many people came through to get it done. Lee March at WOC was a great help, and Tish Hewitt, wonderful friend.
If you would, please, tell us the story of Tish Hewitt. I think it's interesting. You say one thing that you got involved in this for is because you had so much debt, and then to make it happen, you had to go and tell Tish Hewitt, you need to give me some money.
When I was at Bernadette and I were at a party with Tish, and she and I were talking in a corner, and she said, of course, I can never have any friends. I said, what are you talking about? This room is full of them. She said, no, money always gets in the way. And I swore I would never ask her for a dime. But we got down to the beginning of WVIK, and I discovered that the opportunity to apply for a grant we needed had just expired. And I called my friend on the board and explained the situation. He said, well, I can get it open again for a couple of days. He said, they said that we're already served by a public radio station. I said, no, that's a KIAN or something. It was a TV repeater. So he was able to use that to get me more time. But I thought, well, that's great. Where am I going to raise $50,000? And I thought, Tish Hewitt's the only one I know well enough to ask. And I swore I'd never do it. But I called her up, asked if I could meet with her and Bill. I went to their home, explained what I wanted to do. Bill was turned off immediately. And Tish saw that and said, let me call you in the morning. So she called me in the morning and said, I can give you $25,000 this year and $25,000 next year. Great. So we were able to get it done. Years later, when I asked her for, we were looking at acquiring a theater in downtown Rock Island. I went to see her to ask if she'd be interested in helping. And she said, well, I can only give you $50,000. So I said, Tish, that's wonderful, but I've got to explain to you. I told her, I swore I'd never do that. And here I have asked you a second time. She said, yes, Don. But you never ask for yourself.
Yeah, that's the
and
key.
And suddenly I thought of the people around Tish. They had been asking her for money. I couldn't believe it. One Saturday morning, I got a call from her, and she said in a voice lower than mine, Don, you and Bernadette have to join me in the West End. We have a problem we want to deal with tonight. I said, sure. And I got the news at noon that she had died.
Oh.
Flying back. She had to go out to, I think, Omaha to fire somebody who was kind of ripping her off. And I think that emotion got to her, but she had a heart attack and was gone.
And
that ended. Since we hadn't put that agreement in writing, the family didn't honor it.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
But think about that for just a minute. It's not that you were asking her for money, but just imagine a $50,000 investment in the late 1970s, and what dividends have been paid for this community. Kids all over the region can hear the Quad City Symphony Orchestra because of Tish Hewitt's generosity.
Yeah.
People who don't have access to non-profit, public broadcasting journalism, right? I think our biggest problem in journalism is so much of it is profit-driven, except for these nodes and corners like WVIK and NPR.
Yeah,
that's all there because of that investment. It's pretty amazing.
That's true. That curious turn of events got us the biggest grant that year. So, yeah, I have been so lucky throughout my life. One fortunate thing after another, and I act mostly on impulse. I don't know where they come from, but there they are. And they usually turn out to be pretty good.
Well, it was one of them stoic fellas, I can't remember which one, that he said luck is nothing more than preparation intersecting with opportunity.
Yeah.
Well, so when it comes along, you're ready to go.
Yeah, I hadn't particularly prepared for anything, but when I came to buy this house, the door opened, and I thought, I'm going to die in this house.
Huh.
But I couldn't buy it. It cost too much. A year later, it was still on the market. And I figured if I sell the house we're in and get float a couple of loans, I can make it if I sell that house in 6 months. I sold the second house 6 months to the day.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I mean, luck has just followed me around like a puppy. It's wonderful.
Well, let's talk about another founding bit of luck, and that is the Genesius Guild. How did that ever come to be? Because you describe it to someone now, and you describe it to them very plainly, and they say, my goodness, how did little old Rock Island get to have a gem like that?
Yeah.
You couldn't just tell someone that 70 years ago and expect them to back it. How did you pull that one off?
I wanted to act. I joined Playcrafters, but I was working nights at WHBF, and I spent 2 years trying to get on an afternoon shift so I could act. Finally, I was able to do it. We started doing some afternoon shows, and I called up and said, okay, I'm in, and they canceled their season. WOC had offered them a half hour in prime time once a month to do a live show. So they decided to do that instead of their season.
Hmm.
I was so frustrated.
Oh.
So I called. I was doing some teaching on the side then. I called together some students that I directed in plays at Alleman, some friends. So why don't we organize a little play group and do plays that nobody else does? And they said, fine, okay. I tried to get us organized. We met in the living room here 3 times. Nobody wanted to do anything but maybe act. Finally, Joel Hubbs said, look, Don, just tell us what you want us to do and we'll do it. And that's the way the Guild ran for about 60 years.
Yep.
And I said, okay, we'll do a play by Henri Guyon, take off on a miracle play called St. Nicholas and the Three School Clerks. It's called the Sausage Maker's Interlude. We'll intermarshal one-act play competition. We did that in February of 57, won 2 trophies, and the park director said, would you be interested in doing an outdoor play? We're going to start the Starlight Concert Series. I said, sure, why not? I said, where? I said, we'll pick a park. So I went looking around. I had decided to do All My Sons up at Hawberg before I saw what was on the other side of that building in Lincoln Park.
Mm.
When I saw the circle of columns, I thought, Greek play. We'll do a Greek play. I'd never read one, but we'll do one. And as a publicity stunt, we'll do it in mask. So we did. Boy, that was a chore, a real chore. But when I saw that first play, Antigone, I was dumbstruck. I thought, this may be the best play I've ever seen. And it's more contemporary than anything else we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just keep doing this till we get it right. And then along the way, we added Shakespeare, We had an opera. We had professional ballet. It was all free. It was the only such program in the United States, right here in Rock Island. But I was afraid to publicize it because I figured the minute I do, a critic's going to come from Chicago and we'll happen to do a play that I won't be proud of. And rather than risk that, we'll just keep it local. I probably should have, because Janice's Guild was pretty darn good in all their plays.
Well, the reason I think you should rest easy on that regret is by not making it a big deal in Chicago in some sort of Tanglewood West or something like that, you were able to attract people who thought up until that moment they had no business being part of drama.
Yeah.
And then when they became part of a drama, it opened up new vistas for them.
Yeah.
And it used to be some point of pride for you that every show had somebody who had never been on a stage, never memorized a line. And when you would see how those people's lives would flourish, it was really extraordinary. So it's kind of good that you kept it somewhat homegrown and rustic.
Well, I've always been a little hesitant about self-publicity. And I was even in the Senate. I didn't want to get out in front of anything. I was always ready to back somebody else in a project. And I think that served me well. The Genesis Guild, I've told this story before, but after one Greek tragedy, this couple came up to me and thanked me for doing Greek tragedy. Said, "Well, this is the last one we're going to see because we're getting too old to drive." I said, "Oh, where do you come from?" Said, "New Jersey." I said, "What?" He says, "There's no place else we can see these plays." That's when we started investigating who was in the audience. And I was astounded at the range of the audience across Illinois and Iowa and the number of states that were represented. I'm sure they weren't like that couple from New Jersey, but there they were. And that was I was just amazed.
Well, you talked about doing that for 60 years. There are many things that you have done for decades on end, and I just have great memories of, to describe to the listener what these heady days were like. This would be in the 80s, maybe. You were still doing the weather for a local station, and we would all gather getting ready for a show, and then all of a sudden, Don would have to leave with a bare, I'm sure, 30 seconds to spare to jump on the air, give the forecast, and then you would hustle back and help tear down the set because the show was over by that time. You were so hyper-engaged, and when you were in Springfield, you were doing things that nobody had thought of before. You never let the hamstringing of a merciless clock stop you from committing to things. You managed to balance so many things, and you were doing WVIK then at the same time. You're doing all these things, and now you're in a season of your life after those decades when you are not constantly running from thing to thing to thing to thing, but I know from reading your work that your mind is still jumping from thing to thing. So the question is, Don, how is it to make that transition from action, 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 motion, movement, to reflection?
It's difficult.
I can only imagine.
It is difficult, but I am not foolish. When my body tells me you can't stand up without holding on to something, then I don't try without holding on to something. That fall I took in May changed a lot of things. It's left me with blood on the brain, and I have a hematoma on my skull, and I have congestive heart failure, and all kinds of things. So I have to adjust to that. As long as my mind remains alive, I can put up with all of that. I really can. When that goes, I want out. Because the life of the mind, and the mind is the great thing we humans have. There were hominids around on the earth who didn't have that ability until a Homo sapiens came out of Africa. Unfortunately, we brought with us a tendency to kill people, but we did have this ability to think. And I'm appalled at how seldom we try to engage that in ourselves and in each other. When I taught school at Alleman, it was the hardest job I ever had, part-time, standing in front of 20 kids and trying to find a way to get them to think, not just absorb the information, but think about it, discuss it, argue about it, because it's the ability to think that makes the difference. And I, you know, I think that's the greatest gift we have.
Yeah. So something about thinking and tying into an earlier thread in the conversation, neuroscience tells us that when we are afraid and our amygdala is popping off, we are incapable of complex thought. The frontal lobe just shuts down until we can kick it back in. And what you just described is that concern, that alarm, that people can be so easily made to not think. Yeah. What are some of the tips that you've picked up over the years? Because you've been engaged in a lot of contentious issues. How do you, Don, short circuit fear and keep the frontal lobe engaged?
I don't know that you can ever completely short circuit fear, but it helps that if you spend a lot of time thinking about things, you recognize something phony the minute it appears. You recognize somebody's trying to appeal to racism in you. I grew up as a Southerner. I understand racism. It's deep in me, and I have to turn it off when it asserts itself.
Yeah.
If I hadn't had that little incident with Sammy when I was 6 years old, I don't know exactly how my mind would have gone. But to be deprived of a friend because he was black and I was white enraged me so that I never bought into the Southern business of racism. And it's a subtle thing. It's so easy to transfer that to immigrants, people who are different skin color, different religions and all that. Our principles, which were not exactly followed by our founders, but it's right there. All men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Originally, that was to be pursuit of property.
Yeah.
Thank God it was changed to pursuit of happiness. And it has taken us all these years to fully, well, not to fully, but almost fully realize that. You have to go back to the teachings of Jesus to find another example of somebody stating the equality of all humans.
Right. And in part, you know, we owe some of that to the Romans because there were other religious thinkers whose lives and universes were not as diverse as being on the fringes of the Roman Empire. Right. And Jesus had to deal with that. So he could say neither Jew nor Greek. Right. Because there were more than just the Jews around him. Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is very fascinating for me, and I appreciate getting your thoughts on these things. I had the great occasion to have several long conversations with Conrad Bergendorf after he turned 100. We're still waiting for you, Don, so just hurry up there. To think about some of the things he said, and I'll never forget, he was giving an interview once, and I was just observing, and he said, this was in 1995, and he said, well, we really need to keep an eye on China. And my initial response was, oh my goodness, are we veering into xenophobia or something? But the past 25, 30 years have shown he was prescient. China was not the economic powerhouse it was in 1995, right, that it is today. And I don't know, do you sometimes find yourself with these epiphanies that come from observing things closely for decades?
I don't know that I would have anything on that scale, but I recognize China is an older civilization and wiser than we are. You know, you talk about our religious differences. They're mostly about ceremony.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know the down south, the Baptists and the Catholics. Oh, boy. The Baptists have no use for Catholics. And why? Because they dunk and we sprinkle in baptism. What difference does it make? I got to meet some nuns, Buddhist nuns, not long ago, just briefly. But they were putting together some cloths, painted cloths, and the head of the group said, let's make one for Mr. Don. And I hang it, I keep it hanging on the wall between my bedroom and the bathroom, so I see it every day. It's, my religion is very simple. My religion is kindness, the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need. Just be kind.
Yeah. Earlier, when you were talking about racism, you know, you came from a particular time and place in the country, but it's by no means limited there and by no means limited to the South. I grew up in Rock Island. I saw what racism could look like. I know that it's in my heart that I have to be kind in response. But I'll never forget, I was 15 years old and I was visiting a relative in Southern California, and everybody wanted to be in LA, right? There was nothing more advanced and culturally aware than LA, right? But I watched four or five white children, young boys, be so rude and aggressive to an African-American boy of about the same age, because there were four of them and one of him. And that was the lesson for me, is don't read your own press notices. Be aware of what you might be part of and what you should not be part of.
It's important to remember that the brain takes a long time to develop fully. We start out with a lot of impulses and reactions and so on. When you're born, you have two talents, grasping and sucking. And then as you are out of the womb, suddenly the connections start. But the right brain is equally in action with the left brain until the age of about 5 to 7, when the left brain kind of shuts down some all of that noise. When little children talk to an imaginary playmate, they see them. They get answers from them. But once that closes down, unless you're schizophrenic, then the brain continues to grow. When you hit your adolescence, you get this flood of hormones that really screws things up, because you don't have a full brain until you're in your mid-20s, or for men, until 30s. And the last thing to fully develop is the forebrain, where judgment sits. That's why teenagers do crazy things all the time. You just got to understand that they don't have a full brain. How we're going to manage this?
Yeah. Well, Don, we're chatting in midway through your 10th decade, right? I am fascinated when I read your weekly columns and get a chance to converse with you in any format, that you are constantly curious. Something that has grown in intrigue to me in the last 10 years is evolutionary psychology. I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
But what are some of the subjects in this most recent span of your journey that have captured your imagination?
Well, I've always wondered about life. That's been the big question. What is life? Where'd it come from? We don't have a clue. I mean that. We talk about it, but we don't have a clue. There is a book called Becoming Earth, where a guy suggests, once he visited the mines 2 miles deep and found living creatures who seemed to be eating rock and excreting soil. And he thought, wait a minute, maybe the earth we're standing on was created this way. Maybe life was here in the boiling beginning of the planet, because it had to retreat as the planet froze a couple of times, but life was never extinguished, and it won't stop. It wants to keep reproducing. B, it has to kill and eat other living things to survive. 3, to be healthy, it needs play. I mean, but the whole business of life is so mysterious. It just confounds me.
Hmm.
But that's the thing that I have thought more about than anything else, but I don't have any answers.
Not to get too personal, but I know that you and my father were friends, and he was a huge admirer of yours.
He was a great man.
Well, the joke in our family was he left us rather suddenly, and my mother said, you know, he was kind of a seeker religiously and philosophically, and so the joke was, we had a pool. How was he going to go out? Was it going to be Lutheran, Mennonite, conservative Jew, Muslim?
Quaker.
Yeah, she said he went out a Quaker.
Yeah.
So where do you find yourself these days? I know that you're deeply shaped by your Catholicism.
Yeah.
Where do you find yourself?
I find myself just kind of floating on the outside. I'm physically unable to go to Mass and have been for quite a while. And I appreciate the rituals of the church. I grew up loving the music, the ceremony, the Latin, all of it. When John Paul II said we're going to go to the language of the people, that really upset a lot of people because they were fixated on the rituals. The rituals aren't that important. It's the idea. It's the idea of equality and treating everybody well, no matter what. Look at Dorothy Day, who ran this house. Some of the people there were rude, ungracious, filthy, wouldn't stay clean. And the people that worked with her were appalled, but Dorothy said, no, we have to take care of them. I thought, now there's a Christian. There's a deep Christian. I've known a couple of those in my life, and they make me ashamed.
Well, so we were talking about this a bit earlier, too. It isn't just the idealism. We were talking about communism, socialism, so forth. Biggest mistake is to think that the Nordics are social. They're hugely capitalist societies. They really love their toys. But they get that the well-being of the individual is inextricably linked with the well-being of the collective. And if the collective is ill, the individual cannot thrive. And I wonder if there's any hope of us getting back to that aspect of the New Deal understanding of the world.
I don't know, maybe temporarily, but look, Kai, the global warming is going to be our disaster. We have not acted to head it off. And once that takes hold, people living in the equator are going to want to move up here. They don't happen to have the same skin color. We always look at government expenditures. If it goes for somebody we don't have much regard for, we think, wait, why don't they spend that on me? We spend plenty on ourselves. But if we don't have a more universal view of things, it's all going to end in chaos.
Yeah.
It really is. I've said over and over again, it has yet to be determined if there is any survival value in intelligence. Because if we don't use it better, no, we're sunk.
You know, I really wish we could end on a cheerier note, because we're just about out of time, Don.
But, you know, going along, life is great.
You know, and I got to say, mine has been great because of you. So, Don Wooten, thank you. We are just about out of time, but so grateful to have you on The Conversation on WVIK. Next week, I don't even know who's guest. I've just been thinking about this week. Don, thank you.
You've been listening to The Conversation on WVIK. If you missed part of it or just want to hear it again, tune in at 8 o'clock on Monday evening, right here on WVIK.
Hi, I'm Jen Largess, host of This Old House Radio Hour. Every week we bring you stories, skills, and heart that make a house a home. From smart kitchens to old barns, we cover it all. But it's not just about building. It's about belonging. Your support keeps this work alive, so please take a moment to give to your local public radio station. Thank you.
Now more than ever, please donate at WVIK.org, online at WVIK.org, or with the WVIK app, on the radio at WVIK 90.3 FM and HD Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM K240 DZ Dubuque. You're tuned to the Quad Cities NPR station, WVIK.